Hello, this is James Grumvig with Unrestricted Warfare on Decentralized.media. I'm here with Richard Gage, returning guest, AIA architect. He's been a stalwart, relentless researcher on all three towers in New York City that were destroyed in 9/11, right? The Twin Towers, 1 and 2 and 7, which was hit by no plane at all, and had some fires and brush fires on the 7th and 8th floor. And how did that collapse a building? Well, the NIST report kind of fudged everything. And we'll get into that with Richard's presentation coming in a minute. But I want to start off the show showing how long we have been at war with the globalists, and that the plan to build the Twin Towers, to finance in 67, 68, to build it, to open them in the early 70s, and then to destroy them, were all done by one of the same people. Going to blow your mind, but that's what I'm here for. Let's go to video one.
The reason for this unawareness of the frightening danger to our country and to the entire free world is simple. The masterminds behind this great conspiracy have absolute control of all of our mass communications media, especially television, the radio, the press, and Hollywood. The operations of these organizations were and are masterminded and controlled by the internationalist bankers, who in turn were and are controlled by the Rothschilds. Mazzini had enticed an American general named Albert Pike into the Illuminati. Pike was fascinated by the idea of a one-world government. Between 1859 and 1871, he, Pike, worked out a military blueprint for three world wars and various revolutions throughout the world, which he considered would forward the conspiracy to its final stage in the 20th century. Shortly after the Civil War, a young immigrant who called himself Jacob H. Schiff arrived in New York. Jacob came here to carry out four specific assignments. Number one, and most important, was to acquire control of America's money system. Number two, find desirable men who, for a price, would be willing to serve as stooges for the great conspiracy and promote them into high places in our federal government, our Congress, and the U.S. Supreme Court, and all federal agencies. Number three, create minority group strife throughout the nations, particularly between whites and blacks. Number four, create a movement to destroy religion in the United States, but Christianity to be the chief target.
Yeah, this has been happening for the last 50 years. There's no question about it, no denying it. What I've been covering on my show for the last 4 years, it's on different networks. It's just the way it is. Let's get into PowerPoint real quick, because I'm going to hit on something that's very important. And what is that? That is the predictive programming. So in 1967, well, we'll go to 1967 in a minute. This is episode 75 with Richard Gage, AIA architect, shining a light on 9/11 corruption. That is what we're doing. You know where to find me. Here, this is where I want to start. April 3rd, 1967. That is 3 months after the Green Bay Packers won the first Super Bowl. For context, Super Bowl number one. This came right after, 3 months after. There's David Rockefeller on the cover of Newsweek, and his watch in his left hand, on his left wrist, is showing 9/11. He's the one that financed the 9/11 towers. This is a long time, 34 years to be exact, to 2001, 9/11. Is this a mistake? No, this is called predictive programming. They knew the day they were going to take down the World Trade Centers, the globalists, the bankers. Unbelievable, but this is where we're at. But let's go. Here is some information on Richard Gage, his former career, this and that. Let me read his brief bio, then you can find him in a second online. Let's start off. Please welcome San Francisco Bay Area architect Richard Gage, AIA, member of the American Institute of Architects and founder and former CEO of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He, along with his courageous wife, Gail, continues to lead the charge toward a real investigation into the destruction of all three World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11. You can find him at Richard Gage. 911.org, and you'll see it on this next and last slide. Here you go. This is where you can find Richard. Highly recommend you go there. You, as Americans, you should absolutely donate to what Richard's doing so continue his research, which is unparalleled by anybody. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, James. Incredible to be here and talking about this vitally important subject today.
Yeah, I was 7 years old in 1967. And I'm like kind of blown away that, you know, one, that video on the globalist plan, and two, the Newsweek cover story. But it doesn't surprise me anymore, because we're starting to learn how they've been operating. You know, whether it's the 9/11 destruction to COVID-19, it's the same group of players behind the scenes.
It is. That's proven to be the case, though. What we focus on is the scientific forensic evidence in the destruction of all three towers. And I'm looking forward to sharing with your audience today about the third tower, because most Americans still, James, do not even know that a third tower collapsed on 9/11.
Not only did it collapse on 9/11, which really nothing causing the structural failure of that building. And like you said several times before, nothing has ever happened like that before, and nothing ever since. It is one of a kind. It's quite like a unicorn or something strange. And what was also interesting, I had friends who were New York City homicide detectives that were sent out to the Fresh Kill landfill. It was reopened for all the structural stuff that was being shipped out of the Ground Zero. Well, there was one pile that was World Trade Center 1 and 2, and then there was a second pile, small one, obviously, for 7 World Trade Center, and the CIA was running that, and the New York police were nowhere near, they were not allowed anywhere near the 7 World Trade Center debris field. So, yeah, that's red flags for me. Richard?
Oh, all kinds of red flags here. In fact, I'll tell you about it. I can share my screen real quick with you. Well, let's do that. Did I pick the wrong one? I did. I do that every once in a while. Let's pick the right one. And that one. So there we go, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I don't want your audience to be the last to know. I felt like I was the last to know in 5 years after 9/11. It took me to find out that there was some alternative theory about the World Trade Center collapses. I was listening to a radio show, David Ray Griffin. He's written 14 books on the subject of 9/11 truth now. And I was just shocked to hear, first of all, that there was indeed a third tower that came down. I was shocked to hear the evidence, which we're going to be going into some depth here today together. And I couldn't believe it. I felt like my whole world was turning upside down. I had no clue that the media was lying to us. I mean, that's how green I was. But with regard to this third tower, man, it's sure enough, it's no slouching building. It's to be the tallest building in most of our states, but it's only half the height of the Twin Towers. They were the tallest buildings in the world at the time they were built.
Yep.
So still, this is, every floor was an acre in size. It wasn't hit by a plane either, James. This is why we start on it. People theoretically, I mean, according to the official narrative, didn't die in this building. And so we're not, it's been swept under the rug, and for good reason, because it came down even though it wasn't hit by a plane. So here it is standing just fine after the Twin Towers fell, and it had some damage to it from the columns that were laterally ejected out of the North Tower. But NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked by Congress to explain these collapses to the American people, they said this damage was not a significant factor in the building's collapse. Well, let's look at that collapse. The East Penthouse falls first in the upper left, and then 7 seconds later, the entire building does this.
Free fall.
That's free fall, straight down, symmetrical. How does the government explain this? Well, here is Shyam Sunder of NIST explaining this after 7 years of delays.
What we found was that uncontrolled building fires caused an extraordinary event. The collapse of World Trade Center 7 was primarily due to fire.
Fires. Okay, well, let's look at those fires. These are the worst fires that we have any photographic or video evidence of. These are the only fires that we have photographic or video evidence of.
Yeah, it looks like the 7th or 8th floor, give or take, right?
Well, there's one on the 7th. There's one on, more importantly, on the 12th and 13th floor. and the 11th, we have fires in the Securities and Exchange Commission, which was investigating hundreds of cases, having lost thousands of files for those cases, like WorldCom and Enron. Yep. But these fires were burned out over an hour before the building collapsed. And I mean, let's look at some real fires in high rises. We've never lost one high rise, even though they're much larger, longer lasting, and hotter fires in these buildings. They do not collapse. And in fire protected steel frame buildings, not before or after 9/11. And there's been much hotter and larger fires, as you can see, since 9/11, not one of them. So this claim of fire bringing this building down is unprecedented. Well, what is not unprecedented? Take a look on the right. We have a series of known controlled demolitions. On the left, a few different views of Building 7. Is there any similarity? Is there enough similarity to warrant
no resistance, I think, right? No resistance is one.
Yeah. In fact, we'll come to that. But is there enough similarity to warrant an investigation into the possible use of explosives, especially since fire, the official cause of this building's collapse, has never in history brought down a steel frame fire protected building? It should have been the first hypothesis that NIST entertained, but it was not entertained whatsoever. So we have to go and look at the features of controlled demolition and see if Building 7 has any of these features. One by one, is there a sudden onset of destruction? Let's listen to Dan Rather.
Now, here we're going to show you a videotape of the collapse itself.
Describe that.
Now we go to videotape the collapse of this building.
It's amazing.
Amazing, incredible, pick your word. For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before, when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
What was that, Dan? Deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down?
That's a demolition job.
Yeah, he's using his intuition. We've all seen it, like the old hotels in Las Vegas, right? We've seen them on TV. So Dan is using his frame of reference to tell us what he's looking at. Okay, that's great. We should all be doing that, but he didn't repeat that after 9/11. He didn't. In fact, we haven't seen it at all any videos, except two, actually, after 9/11 of this building's collapse. I'm one of 90,000 members of the American Institute of Architects. We didn't get issued one bulletin on this, the third worst structural failure in modern history. Should have been the most studied building failure ever. And yet, nope, it's been swept under the rug also. So let's see if we have a straight down symmetrical progression of the building. This is feature number two. Let's look from West Street. Pretty straight down, pretty symmetrical. They don't want these buildings tipping over. How do they do that? Well, they have to take out all of the core columns in the building. It, within a fraction of a second of each other, followed about a second later by the perimeter columns all at once, and repeat that on every floor. If there's any deviation in that pattern, the building will begin to tip over.
And it would take months to you know, set all the charges in the building, wouldn't it?
Oh yeah, it would. This did not happen the day of 9/11. This building was on fire. Nobody's going into a burning building to set charges on the fire. So with that symmetry requirement of those columns all at once, can these fires cause that precision of damage?
Absolutely not.
It's untenable, right? The whole thing is untenable. Look how fast the building is coming down. You mentioned free fall. David Chandler confirmed that. It comes down at free fall for at least a third of its 7-second fall. Well, wait, what does that mean? That means that not one of these columns gave any resistance for at least at all. And there's 82 of them on every floor. So where did they go? NIST actually acknowledged that this was free fall, but they don't acknowledge the implications of that free fall, that these columns had to have disappeared all at once, synchronistically timed on each floor. They do not acknowledge that. And the pile, I mean, look at the pile. It's a house of cards. We had a 47-story moment-resisting steel frame structure that is should have created a pile if it was going to collapse at all, 20 stories tall or tipping over. But here, every column is severed from every beam, and it falls in a 4 to 6 story pile. So buildings that collapse naturally, in this case due to earthquakes, we can recognize the building at the bottom. It's certainly damaged, but the columns and beams are not severed one from another. The concrete is not pulverized to a fine powder, as we'll see. So how does that happen? Well, let's look for witnesses of any explosions. Here's Daryl, a medical student, interviewed that afternoon on 1010 Winds Radio.
We were watching the building, actually, because it was on fire. The bottom floors of the building were on fire. And, you know, we heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. Turned around, we were shocked to see that the building was, well, it looked like there was a shock wave ripping through the building, and the windows all busted out, and, you know, it was horrifying. And then, you know, about a second later, the bottom floor caved out, and the building followed after that, and we saw the building crash down all the way to the ground.
About a second later, the building started falling. So there's a specific order of events. Listen to this gentleman.
You heard explosions, like boom. It's like a distinct sound. It's not like when in compression, like boom, 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 like floors that were dropping and collapsing. This was boom, and like you felt a rumble in the ground, like almost like you wanted to grab onto something. That, to me, I knew that was an explosion. There was no doubt in my mind.
Nor the mind of Bill Rosati, who saw building flashes in the building.
I was standing like two blocks away, and all of a sudden I just seen a big flash, and then I seen the building coming down, and I just seen people just running everywhere, chaotic-like.
And Captain Richard Patterson of the Fire Department in New York.
1-7 let go as well, and was also similar with, although not as loud because I was further away, a series of concussive explosions.
And Patrick Dillon, first responder.
I remember feeling that, like it was like freight trains underneath the earth, shaking the earth, even shaking me. That's when we all saw Building 7 crumple in the middle, like way up at the top. It buckled, and then dropped.
Okay, this is very helpful testimony. Was there any foreknowledge? Because if these were planned in advance, people would know about it in advance. Chief Nick Fascani says, hey, we're moving the command post over this way. That building's coming down, referring to Building 7. And Chief Hayden, who says, if we asked an engineer, if we allowed it to burn, could we anticipate a collapse? And how soon? Well, he was pretty much right on the money, he said. In its current state, you have about 5 hours. Wait a minute. No steel frame fire protected building has ever collapsed due to fire. And all of a sudden, he's saying not only that it's going to collapse, but exactly when. And indeed, it collapsed 5 hours later. They won't release the name of this engineer, though. He's anonymous. What about these mysterious construction workers, though? Hearing an explosion over their shoulder, looking back at the building, and then looking straight into the CNN camera and saying this.
Holy boy. You hear that?
Keep your eye on that building. It'll be coming down.
Building is about to blow up. Move it back.
All right, guys.
We are looking back. There's a building about to blow up. Full flame. Debris coming down.
The building is about to blow up. Flame and debris coming down. How do they know? They must have known in advance. And speaking of advanced knowledge, what about this encounter?
And he pointed to what turned out to be the entrance to Building 7's lobby. He said, go in there, go in there, take a break, take a break. There's other guys in there, like that. And that's what I did. I finished coming down off the pile and climbed over the wreckage of Vesey, and went into those revolving doors and just kind of fell on the floor. There were other guys in there doing the same thing I was, just shaking their heads and spitting out poison and trying to get their, you know, get their lungs back together again, as I was. And I was on the floor. These battalion chiefs come in through the revolving doors. There was three of them. They had the white helmets. I didn't get any IDs off them. But as soon as they stepped inside, what stepped in behind them were these two people in black with black ski masks on and Uzis. And the Uzis were, you know, hanging off their necks. And I don't know what they were or who they were, but the battalion chiefs started yelling at us, right, ordering us to get out of this building. They're going to pull the building. Everybody out now. And they ordered us back out.
Wow, that's pretty incredible.
Richard, what didn't Lucky Larry Silverstein say pull it?
He did, and we'll come to that. You bet.
Keep going.
But before that, we have Kevin McPadden, who heard those explosions. But what did he was held back about a few blocks because they're expecting Building 7 to come down. And he's listening to the radio held in the hands of a Red Cross worker. And he hears this.
At the last few seconds, he took his hand off and you heard 3, 2, 1.
Okay. Do fires bring buildings down to countdowns? I don't think so. And the BBC announcing this collapse early on.
Now, more on the latest building collapse in New York. You might have heard a few moments ago was talking about the Salomon Brothers building collapsing. And indeed it has. Apparently that's only a few hundred yards away from where the World Trade Center towers were. And it seems that this was not a result of a new attack. It was because the building had been weakened during this morning's attack. Probably find out more now about that from our correspondent.
They've got the reason.
Jane, what more can you tell us about the Salomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy.
Sketchy indeed. They apologize for this grievous error later, citing the confusing events of the day. What does this make them
23 minutes before? So they got the script. I'm going to say what I'm going to say from the CIA and or Mossad or whatever, Five Eyes, from whatever intel agency was involved in this. And boom, there we go.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And you mentioned, totally. And you mentioned Lucky Larry, who purchased the other six buildings of the World Trade Center. He had already built Building 7 in the 80s. He's being interviewed on PBS, and this is what he says about the collapse of Building 7.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. And I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
Firefighters don't make a decision to pull a building.
He said it twice. He said it twice, no less. In the New York City DOB website got rid of the new seven World Trade Center plans that Larry had approved months before 9/11 took place. I know that. I used to be in construction management for 30 years in New York City. So lo and behold, by 2004 or 5, they had a brand new 7 World Trade Center. Amazing.
Yeah, he announced that they were they started the design in April of 2001, which is 6 months before 9/11. So that was a public announcement in Israel that he acknowledged.
Correct.
So pretty interesting. He doesn't go into detail about it.
And then, of course, he bought the double insurance on the separate World Trade Centers.
Oh, yeah. He walked away with $5.68 billion. He did very well, having invested only $15 million of his own money.
Yeah, money laundering.
And what about the experts?
My opinion.
Oh, yeah, a lot of it going on. And here's one of the top European controlled demolition experts.
Danny Jawenko is the expert on this in Europe. What did he say?
This is controlled demolition.
Zeker weten.
Zeker weten. Er is naast gekomen. Dit is in opdracht gebeurd. Het heeft een team gedaan van experts.
Very helpful. And Kamal Obeid, one of 36 structural engineers, signed on to the petition demanding a new investigation. 3,600 architects and engineers all together. A localized failure in a steel frame building, he says, like World Trade Center 7, cannot cause a catastrophic collapse like a house of cards without a simultaneous and patterned loss of several of its columns at key locations within the building. Well, does that sound like something fires can do?
No.
No, which is why the University of Alaska in Fairbanks picked this up. One of the top forensic structural engineers in the country, Professor Leroy Halsey, analyzed the building and the responses it had to fires, mimicking the input data from NIST, and proved on the left here that the building can come down like the video in the middle only if you take out all the columns in the building. Whereas the U.S. government on the right, their computer model looks nothing like the official collapse. It starts to tip over, so they stop it after 2 seconds of its collapse. They don't want us to see it tipping over. They can't even mimic what the building is doing.
And the penthouse was the first of the columns, I guess, demolished or blown up or whatever, right?
Yeah, the east penthouse comes down first. And as you can see on the upper left, they all get that fairly right. It's an isolated event, though, because there's nothing going on in the video on the left side under the penthouse.
There's no fire at the top of the building at all.
No, this is an isolated event. Perhaps the explosions went off early. NIST is trying to justify it with an overall collapse on the left side of the building, which there's no, it would have broken all the windows on that side and massive crumpling of the exterior cladding. So it's ridiculous. So the Alaska study finds that the fire did not cause the collapse. The temperatures were not hot enough to cause the weakening of the steel framing. Thermal expansion did not result in a loss of support for the beams and girders. And the building didn't experience a progressive collapse, as claimed by NIST, but a global collapse caused by the near simultaneous failure of all of its columns. So that's something only controlled demolition can do. We'd be looking for the source of those, and we find them as incendiaries in the form of evidence of ignited thermite, which is given to us by FEMA on a silver platter in Appendix C of their 2002 Building Performance Assessment Team report. And what do they find in this metallurgical examination? Never before observed eutectic reactions causing intergranular melting, like turning a solid steel girder into Swiss cheese.
Richard, like, for the audience, what does eutectic mean?
Eutectic is a way of lowering the melting point of steel by injecting sulfur in it. So they found all this sulfur, as you'll see in a minute, attack on the steel. That creates a eutectic, which creates these Swiss cheese-like holes. Fire doesn't do this. Fire is only about 500 or 600 degrees, especially these fires in this building. NIST claims twice that. But still, that cannot cause and never has steel to be attacked like is defined here with rapid oxidation, sulfidation, liquid eutectic mixture containing primarily iron. What is liquid iron? That's molten iron. Now, typically that's 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's up to 4 to 6 times more temperature required here than fires can even get to. Hot sulfur formed during this hot corrosion attack on the steel. This is incredible. Not found in office fires whatsoever. In fact, FEMA called it perhaps the deepest mystery uncovered. Excuse me. The New York Times called this the deepest mystery uncovered in the investigation. But it was completely ignored by NIST. In fact, it was omitted from the NIST report. They threw it out, all this evidence. But their author of the FEMA report says steel members in the debris pile appear to have been partly evaporated in extraordinarily high temperatures. Well, wait a minute. It takes 4,000 degrees to evaporate steel. So where's the temperature coming from? There's nothing in the official narrative to account for this. I saw melting of girders in the World Trade Center, says the structural engineer, given access to the Freshkills landfill to study the steel paid for by the National Science Foundation grant. So they acknowledge that, gosh, we have molten metal pouring out of the buckets from the crab claw excavators. We can tell the temperature of molten metals by their color. That's just the physics of how this works. We're exceeding 2,500 degrees here in this photograph. Again, no accounting. Not even jet fuel burns anywhere near that hot. 600 degrees maximum in open air, according to ME Petroleum, its manufacturer. So if that was evidence of ignited incendiaries, and it can only be, is there any evidence of unignited incendiaries in the World Trade Center dust? Excuse me. In this case, evidence of ignited incendiaries, but in this case, in the dust. The USGS gives it to us, again, on a silver platter. 2005, their particle atlas of the World Trade Center dust, doing hundreds of different samples and studying them. What do they find in all of them? Previously molten iron microspheres about the diameter of a human hair, billions of them. Where do they come from? They don't know. But they acknowledge that up to 6% of these dust samples are full of these previously molten iron microspheres. Let's break that down. Previously molten, that means 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. Iron, we haven't used iron in our skyscrapers for 100 years. So how do they get to be iron? So iron is the byproduct of thermite. Thermite is an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. That's how incendiaries work. At 4,000 degree temperatures, they destroy steel. That's their purpose. And whereas in high energy explosives like TNT or RDX, they destroy by means of gas expansion, which knocks things over. There's up to 4 tons of this stuff by extrapolation in all the World Trade Center dust, and yet they don't know where it came from. The EPA says it's a signature component. In other words, this isn't even World Trade Center dust unless it has these previously molten iron microspheres in it. RJ Lee finds them. They're an environmental consulting firm. They say they're formed during the event, not before, by the iron workers putting the building together, not afterward, by the iron workers taking it apart, but during the event. Well, experiment is the arbiter of competing hypotheses. Let's do an experiment. Let's light some thermite. What does it produce? Molten iron microspheres, thousands of them in this case, which cool and fall into the pan as previously molten iron microspheres. Why are they spherical? That's just what aerosolized liquids do under pressure. The surface tension forms into a sphere. Could that be what's causing the tops of these cars to be toasted? Liquid falling molten iron microspheres. Burning the paint and burning the cars. There's other sources like explosions that are the source of some of these, but there's no other accounting in the official narrative of the toasting of the tops of these cars. And, okay, so if that was all evidence of ignited thermite and it can only be that. Is there any evidence of unignited thermite in the World Trade Center dust? Well, a team of eight international scientists, led here by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen, sample seven independently collected samples that were sent to them, and they test them. And they find the same curious red-gray chips. They're attracted to a magnet, so they have a high iron content. That's not like paint. So they get curious, and they do X-ray energy dispersive spectroscopy on the red layer. What do they find? Iron and aluminum, the ingredients of thermite in all of these red-gray chips. Well, that's real curious. What's that doing there? They zoom in 50,000 times with an electron microscope, and they find what? Nano-sized particles of iron oxide rhomboidal-shaped crystals, aluminum platelets, 1,000 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. If you can imagine this, this is highly engineered stuff. And it's laid in a matrix, mixed in a matrix of oxygen, carbon, and silica. Organic material. Organic material is what they put in TNT to expand rapidly and knock things over. Well, this is an incendiary that's been engineered to become more explosive. It's very interesting. It was developed by Lawrence Livermore Lab. They called it super thermite. And as such, they put it in a differential scanning calorimeter at the lab in Lawrence Livermore. And at about 850 degrees, it ignites. Well, what does it produce when it ignites? The same thing that the independently collected samples did and given to this team of eight international scientists produced. Molten iron microspheres with the same chemical signature as the molten iron microspheres that we just talked about found by the USGS and R.J. Lee.
Amazing.
It is. We know exactly where those microspheres came from. It's not a puzzle anymore, as if we didn't know. They're found attached to partially ignited red-gray chips, as you see here and here. This is very sophisticated material. Not made in a cave in Afghanistan. Made only in the most advanced defense contract.
And not loaded into a building in a week or a month or anything like that either.
No. No, this is a huge project. And even the analysis of these red-gray chips was huge. It's put in the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal in a 25-page peer-reviewed paper. They conclude that the red layer is active, unreacted thermitic material incorporating nanotechnology. It's a highly energetic pyrotechnic or explosive material. So this is 2009. We've been telling members of Congress and the media about this since then, many times, including we've gone back and we've shown them
our 15 years.
18 for me.
I know, but going back to this one report here, 15 years, but yes.
18. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The truth for all Americans, 23 years coming up in the fall.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it's still an incredibly useful piece of evidence that we combine with our other evidence, our 3,600 architects who have signed the petition, our documentaries, our books that we've written. It is an amazing set of evidence that we've just highlighted in terms of Building 7 here.
Yep.
So we've got all the key characteristic features and some very uncharacteristic features of controlled demolition. Fire doesn't account for any one of these, let alone all 10 of them. It's direct evidence of destruction with explosives, in this case, incendiaries. With additional circumstantial and corroborative evidence and testimony, we find this proof of controlled demolition, a body of proof that's convinced those 3,600 architects and engineers. You can see their petition at richardgage911.org, and many of them will be included in our film series, 9/11 Crime Scene to courtroom, taking the hard evidence of 9/11 to court. And we're encouraging everybody to co-produce this film with us. We're in editing now. We've filmed in Washington, D.C. with Mick Harrison, the litigation director of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, and myself are now editing the film in with Stev in Australia, our wonderful editor. And we're going to be submitting that film series, which comes out next later this month. We'll be submitting it to a grand jury for a special grand jury investigation.
Wow.
And we're not going to stop until we get one, because regarding the Twin Towers, I mean, just look, we have to look at the Twin Towers and ask ourselves, are we looking at a collapse or an explosion? Here, shown side by side, the South Tower on the left, the North Tower on the right. Is there any similarity? Yeah. Upward, outward, arching streamers, a geometry of fireworks, freely flying structural steel sections, ejected laterally, trailed by thick white smoke clouds. What are those thick white smoke clouds? Well, thermite is an incendiary. It issues aluminum oxide as its other byproduct, aluminum oxide ash. And that is the byproduct number two. We talked about molten iron already. So here we can see the evidence of thermite incendiaries, because steel is not flammable. It's not like you take a 2x4 out of a burning building and you throw it across the street, it's going to trail a cloud. Steel is not flammable unless you put molten iron, or unless you put thermite-shaped cutter charges on it, which were developed and patented prior to 9/11. So let's look and see if we have any of the key characteristic features of controlled demolition. Is there a sudden onset of destruction? Yeah. The building is standing there, and all of a sudden, the North Tower is in downward uniform acceleration. No jolt, no hesitation.
That's the North Tower with the radio antenna on top.
Correct. And no jolt, no hesitation when it meets the a cold, hard, intact steel below, right? It's going to provide some resistance, but not in this case, not much at all. How about the South Tower? It's standing still, and all of a sudden, it's in uniform downward motion.
And for the audience, the South Tower was the observation deck on the World Trade Center. I visited my cousin in Norway in 1999. Keep going, Richard.
So World Trade Center, Windows on the World was in the South Tower.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. I have to get that straight. We're told that the upper part of the building drove the rest of the building down to the ground and then crushed itself. This is called the crush down, crush up theory. This theory, which remains NIST's theoretical basis for its column failure theory, was developed in just 2 days by Zdenek Bazant, a mathematical wizard at the Northwestern University in Chicago. He calls it the crush down, crush up theory. The rest of us were in shock, right? When's the next building going to be hit? The next plane coming at us? Who did this? And not this guy. He was in his den, apparently, doing nothing but creating the mathematical obfuscation of what really happened that took engineers 10 years to decode. And it was submitted for peer-reviewed and published, but it was submitted 2 days, just 2 days after 9/11. It suffers from a number of problems, one of which is Newton's third law of motion. There's an equal and opposite destructive force when two bodies collide, like a Volkswagen and a Mack truck, for instance. Does it matter if you drop the Volkswagen on the Mack truck? No. Still, equal and opposite destruction. The lightest part of the structure cannot possibly destroy the cold, hard, heavier, intact steel below. Up at the top, we have lightweight beams, but they get heavier and heavier and heavier as you go down the building.
That's a really good schematic you just showed there.
Yeah, I thought so too. 36 inches wide by 16 inches wide by 2 inches thick at mid-height, but they get heavier and heavier and heavier and heavier until they're almost solid steel, 52 inches by 22 inches.
So, Richard, you're essentially saying a bird nest can't take down a tree is what you're telling me. With the
there brain. You go. The bird nest cannot take down the tree. The upper part of a tree cannot take down the tree below it. But that's what we're told is happening here. Look at it. It's not driving down the rest of the building. Here, let me make it easier on you. Look at the lower red line. The upper part is destroying itself. It's telescoping in on itself. It's being destroyed, but by something else. What? Because it's not crushing the rest of the building. If it were, we would see it driving the rest of the building down to the ground. It would be there, but it's not. It's missing. What we see instead, upward, outward, arching streamers, a geometry of fireworks, freely flying, molten objects trailed by thick white smoke clouds. Looks more like the volcanic eruption of the Tongan Sea in 2009. We talked about what could produce that. Aluminum oxide ash trailing 4-ton structural steel sections. And the upper part didn't destroy the lower part, obviously, because a good percentage of the lower part of these core columns is standing 1,000 feet in the air for 7 seconds until it's hit by an explosion and it drops frame by frame through the concrete powder that's been shaken off of it. So we have a completely phony theory here produced by Zdeněk Bezant. It looks more like this, right? With explosions blowing out the structural steel sections. And this is completely ignored in the NIST report, which took 2 years and 20 million dollars, 10,000 pages, complete obfuscation all over again of what really happened here. They were tasked by Congress to explain how and why these Trade Center towers collapsed. They didn't do it. But these guys do it. These are witnesses, not 118, not 156, but now 186 witnesses of explosions on record, orally taped in the oral histories. What do they say? We felt the ground shake. You could see the tower sway, and then it just came down. Wait a minute. They're hearing a specific order of events. They're seeing a specific order of events. They're feeling the ground shaking. And before the tower collapses, like this, all of a sudden, the ground just started shaking. Felt like a train running under my feet. The next thing we know, we look up and the tower is collapsing. Shortly before the first tower came down, I remember feeling the ground shaking. I heard a terrible noise and then debris just started flying everywhere. I saw a flash, flash, flash at the lower level of the building. You know, like when they demolish a building? With each popping sound, initially an orange and then a red flash came out of the building and then it would just go all around the building on both sides. Saw a number of brief light sources being emitted from inside the building between floors 10 and 15. He saw about 6 of these brief flashes accompanied by a crackling sound before the tower collapsed. I saw low-level flashes. I saw flash, 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 and then it looked like the building came down. You ever see professional demolition where they set charges on certain floors and you hear the pop, pop, pop? When I heard that friggin' noise, that's when I saw the building coming down. An explosion appeared at the very top simultaneously from all 4 sides. Material shot out horizontally. And then there seemed to be a momentary delay before you could see the beginning of the collapse. How specific does it need to be, James? And it goes on and on and on.
On and 100, on.
It's 186 of them. It's incredible. And we've got to ask ourselves, feature number 3, is there a straight down symmetrical collapse? Well, the south tower begins to actually fall over. In fact, it falls over at 20 degrees. So it's falling over off the building below it. So there's asymmetrical loading on the building. There's asymmetrical damage from the fires up above. There's asymmetrical damage from the building of the airplane impacts. How in the world then do we get complete symmetrical damage all the way around all four sides of each of these buildings? It makes no sense. Absent pre-placed, synchronized explosions, which we can see exactly that right here before our eyes in this looped video, I see about a dozen small, independent explosions. This is not nuclear weapon going off, destroying the building. This is not energy weapons. These are pre-placed, individually synchronized explosions. And we can see them well below the zone of destruction, 20 stories down below, 40 stories down below. We even see these isolated explosive ejections called squibs 60 stories down below. There's no accounting for these in the official narrative, absent the early detonation.
Well below where the two planes hit the Twin Towers.
60 stories down below, too. Well, yep. Take a look on the left side of the South Tower. All at once, a dozen isolated explosive ejections going off. In fact, compromising the rigidity of the interior structure so that it can't act as a rigid body and roll off the building as it begins to tip over. No, it's the structure's being liquefied, essentially, and it just settles back.
Because had the building not fallen down, it would have been a crime scene to investigate, wouldn't it?
It's still a crime scene.
Yeah, no question. I agree with you.
They declared it an act of war, so they weren't bound by the requirements of the illegal destruction of crime scene evidence.
Right, and they sent a lot of the steel to China almost immediately.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. And how fast is this building coming down? Free fall acceleration. Wait a minute. This is clocked by physicists, in this case, David Chandler. He says it's two-thirds of free fall acceleration, meaning it's not slowing down. It's still getting faster and faster and faster, just not quite as faster and faster and faster as a bowling ball. It should have been slowing down when it meets what? All of this steel, which is actually 20 times stronger than it needed to be to carry the gravity loads here due to the Varendeel truss design that was designed to carry the force of hurricane winds up at the top of the building. It all of a sudden, or as a result, becomes much more strength. But all that just gave way. 90% of it gone. There's 287 massive columns, 47 core columns, and 240 perimeter columns. It's an incredible structure. And yet it came apart in pieces, laterally ejected 4- and 8-ton structural steel sections from the exterior, impaling themselves.
And for the audience, this is a building located across West Street from the World Trade Center. And my niece was living in one of these apartment buildings, by the way. Just keep going.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I hope it wasn't that one.
No, she survived, though, but it did damage, part of her building, for sure.
Yeah, the World Financial Trade Center, the World Financial Center was highly damaged. The Winter Gardens were destroyed. They had to rebuild those 600 feet away, by the way. Now, how does gravity work? Down. What are we seeing here? Out. Outward arching streamers. In this case, laterally ejected, freely flying, back, two, forward, two, freely flying. That one's about to hit the World Trade Center, 7. Well, wait a minute. Back to trailing what? Thick white smoke clouds. Is steel flammable? No. What can this only be, given all the evidence we've seen already? Aluminum oxide ash. Plus, there's enough force here. Gravity works down, but this is out. There's enough force here to deliver a 200-pound cannonball 3 miles. There's hundreds of these. This is an incredible quantity of forces that can be calculated, and nothing in the official narrative can account for it. The building's only 200 feet wide, but the debris radius is over 1,200 feet, well beyond the boundary of the World Trade Center.
The footprint, correct.
Yeah, impacting buildings all well outside the Trade Center, in fact. And if that's true, and it is, obviously, if 100,000 tons of steel framing is distributed outside the footprint, what's crushing the building? This is over half the weight of the building, included, by the way, in Zdenek-Bazant's mathematical equation showing how the building was destroyed. But it's not there to crush the building. That's not steel. Must have been the concrete. Let's go see. Because we have 110 floors in the buildings, each of them, an acre in size, poured concrete over metal decking over lightweight steel trusses. But where are they? We don't see 50 of them at the bottom. That's half of them. We don't see 10. We don't even see one acre-sized floor, half acre or quarter acre.
Yeah, let me inject real quick. I was a forensic inspector for a civil engineering firm in L'Ambiance Plaza collapse up in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 1987. They're using a some kind of lift thrust, a very special technique of pouring the concrete slabs on the ground, then lifting them up, and then doing the same the next. And it got up to 11 or 14 stories, and it collapsed during construction.
Oh, and you were involved in that. Oh,
I was involved in the with the Bureau of Standards and OSHA and everything else. I got involved came after the fact, and it was pancaked, like you said. But none of that exists here at all.
You saw the pancakes there, huh?
Nope, how many? No question.
How many pancakes did you see?
Saw probably about 8 out of 11.
Wow. Wow. So that's what you would see. In fact, you see that here on the right.
That's what I'm talking about right there.
And collapse. Yeah. In this case, Mexico. Where are the 110 pancakes? It's completely missing.
Not one.
Wait a minute. Here's the concrete pulverized in midair. Whoa. All the photos, all the videos show 90,000 tons of concrete from each building pulverized in midair and spread laterally over Manhattan, pulverized to 100 micron particles, by the way. This is like baby powder landing like an ash from a volcano 3 inches thick all through lower Manhattan in 3 square miles. By the way, if 90,000 tons of concrete's pulverized and spread from river to river across lower Manhattan, what's crushing the building? It wasn't the steel, and it sure as heck is not the concrete. Here's another, almost half the weight of the building. 7/8 the weight of this building is steel and concrete. It wasn't available to do the crush down, crush up theory of Zdenek-Bazant. It's complete fraud. And it's proven right here. It's proven in his papers because they were decoded. And when they were decoded, the engineers like Tony Zambodi found that they in fact doubled the mass up above. And they decreased the column strength below by a factor of 3.
Oh, so that's how you make, it's sort of like the CDC statistics for COVID. Just, you know.
Very good.
Just saying.
Yep. They doubled the problem, the disease and the deaths from it. And they decreased the problem from the solution, the false solution to the false disease. And that's what Zdenek-Bazant from Chicago University, Northwestern University did here. False input data. And this was challenged by engineers, refuted and they submitted papers refuting in the Journal of Engineering Mechanics, the original paper put forth by Zdenek-Bazant, and the American Society of Civil Engineers said, we're not going to publish this. Why? Because it's out of scope. Wait a minute.
Wait, hold it.
It's out of scope to challenge a previously published peer-reviewed paper since when?
So how come the American Society of Civil Engineers is that a government bureaucracy by any chance?
No, happens, and it's worse than that. This is the association of 200,000 engineers, and they represent those engineers. This is a complete violation of ethics and law, as it turns out. They're being sued now over this.
I'm glad. Richard, just to let you know, we got 5 minutes left in the show. Keep going.
Okay. We have the illegal destruction of evidence in a crime scene, easily the largest and most perplexing structural failures in history. 400 truckloads a day, starting just 2 weeks after 9/11, carting this steel to the landfill, being put on barges, sent to China for recycling, prompting Bill Manning, editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering Magazine, to cry out, "Crucial evidence that could answer many questions is on the slow boat to China," showing an astounding ignorance of government officials to the value of a thorough scientific investigation. The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately, but it didn't. And that's why, with all the key characteristic and some very uncharacteristic features of controlled demolition, that's why we have 3,600 architects and engineers signed on to the petition, appearing in the film series that we talked about. Many of them appear in the documentaries, 9/11 Explosive Evidence Experts Speak Out, 7, the story of the Halsey Study from the University of Alaska, and actor Ed Asner narrating the 15-minute documentary, Building 7. All this evidence is outlined on our brochure, which you can print, download and print for free, because this is really important. Brown University documented very carefully the staggering costs of this war, including $14 trillion in Afghanistan, which was a complete failure, and $8 trillion in the other post-9/11 wars, complete failure. So the truth about 9/11 is extremely dark. Where do we draw our line in the sand? Do we wait for the next 9/11? I have news for you. Like James told us, it's already happened in the last 3 years. So let's get out there and speak the truth about both of these false flag operations. I know we're only a small piece of the puzzle, individually, but working together,
boom,
our power is incredible.
That was 13 dominoes. If I had 29 dominoes, the last domino would be as tall as the Empire State Building.
And that's what we're up against, that kind of power. And if we all work together and share this podcast, James's and my podcast here, with even just two people, and have them share that with two more, we can leverage ourselves incredibly. That's what we wanted to bring to the attention of our listeners and viewers today, James.
Richard, that is a phenomenal presentation, the best one you've done yet, the best one I've ever seen, the most thorough. And this is the way we're going to win this war. Now, we've got like 2 minutes left. The documentary you're going to hand in as evidence into a grand jury, you said?
Yeah.
Is that going to be shown to the public afterwards, or what's
Before, actually. We're producing this for the grand jury eventually, but we're putting it out on YouTube this month. Then with a grand jury, we're going to break it down section by section. Molten metal, iron oxide, ash, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Explosions witnesses, and give it to them in bite-sized pieces.
That's terrific. So people go to your website, right? RichardGage911.org, and they can donate and become a kind of a co-producer or a mini producer or something, or help crowdfund this documentary, correct?
That's absolutely correct. The funds go straight into the film project. And if you find the film project funding mechanism there on the top of our website.
So you got your marching orders, audience. I'll leave the link to Richard in the show notes, so you can go and donate, because you need to be part of history, and this is the best way to do it. Thank you, Richard. You're absolutely amazing. I love the work. I love your determination, and God bless you.
Thank you so much, James. Appreciate it, and we'll get there.
Great. Thank you.